Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. On this episode of Celeb Savant, I'll be speaking to Anthony Phillips. Anthony is an English musician, songwriter, producer, and singer who gained prominence as original lead guitarist of the rock band Genesis. He left the band in July 1970. Phillips released his first solo album, The Geese and the Ghost, in 1977. He continues to release solo material, including further solo albums, television and film music, collaborations with several artists, and compilation albums of his recordings. Up next on Celeb Savant, we will be speaking to Anthony Phillips. Where do we find you in the world? What's happening in your life, and how are you doing?
Well, I've had a bit of a rough year in terms of physical side, actually. I've had unfortunately been sort of grounded musically slightly with maybe old age is catching up on me. But yeah, I had a right wrist problem, which sorted itself out after about 4 or 5 months. And I couldn't play much during that time. And then my physio thinks that I overcompensated. This is all very boring. And so then I've had an issue with my left shoulder and neck inflammation. So I spent a lot of this year sort of I suppose in football terms, it would be, since we've got a big tournament at the moment, you know, sort of I'm on the injury table. So it's been kind of frustrating, really. But luckily, there's still back catalogue stuff to put out. And I'm still involved in library music and stuff like that. So, you know, there's always things being pushed and things happening. But it's been frustrating in terms of new material, because I felt very restricted by it. But, you know, this has happened to so many people in the past. I mean, poor Keith Emerson being one of the most disastrous examples. I know a number of electric guitarists who suffer with left shoulder problems because of the years of the heavy electric guitar on the left shoulder. And I think at sort of when you get into your late 60s, 70s, you do start to sort of the 50 years of thrashing away, the wear and tear. You tend to forget it's the same body that's the one that won't let you, you know, sort of pole vault anymore, you know, stuff like that. But you somehow think this body is immune to the, any restrictions when it comes to playing. But no, buddy, it's the same body. So you have to learn to manage it.
Hopefully you're healing and getting better. So let's take it. Yes, you've mentioned it's been a number of years. So let's take it back to the Anthony Phillips story, the hybrid version of your musical journey. I know, like I said, it's many decades. But for those listeners who don't know the Anthony Phillips story, let's get your story from your mouth, the hybrid version.
You don't want the modern electric one?
Your whole story, your whole musical story.
I was joking about cars, hybrid and now electric, yeah.
Oh,
I've got no plug-in point here, sorry. I'm only hybrid still, so that's all I can offer. Let's keep it hybrid. We'll keep it hybrid.
You're killing me.
Well, the Anthony Phillips story, I mean, how far do you back do you want me to go?
From the beginning, what motivated you to get into music as a child, teenager, and how it progressed from there?
I think another guy at school playing the guitar, and also we had an impromptu band. I was away at what we call boarding school here. Well, we call it public school, but of course it's actually private school. You know, it's one of those English things where it's just a trick. You know, it's the wrong way around, so you can laugh at foreigners when they get it wrong. It's pathetic, really. But yeah, prison camp, or private school, aka prison camp. So you're kind of locked away in this place for sort of two-thirds of the year. But yeah, no, we're kind of talking early to mid-60s, sorry, early-ish 60s, just before the Beatles. So there was a track called My Old Man's a Dustman by Lonnie Donegan. And a couple of guys played the guitar badly. And I sort of said, I'll do the vocals. And so we went into the school hut, and suddenly there was an announcement, you know, impromptu concert. So probably about 80 or 90 boys turned up. I probably forgot the words and got sacked. So I thought, this isn't a good start for my vocalist career. So let's switch to guitar. And it's funny, because I had lessons to start with this brilliant classical guitarist who wanted me to do the conventional thing. And by the time I started the lessons, the Beatles had come out, and you know it's hard to describe the impact of that at the time because it was very, very new. Very, you know, Please Please Me was a complete, you know, you just sort of sat back and it was like, well, I must say it was like meeting with God, but you know, it was a sort of talk about stunning, stunning revelation. And I think so many people were affected by the vibrancy, the melodic quality. You know, they had everything really, and it was something that we'd not heard before, so I had to discover it. So what I used to do was get the guy to teach me the chords, and so I learned to play pop songs via chords. I didn't learn to read music at that stage, so basically that started an era of as I moved to the next school, pooling together guys that were good drummers, good bassists. The band we had at prep school was dreadful. We had one guy used to play D7 the whole way through every song. That's any chord he knew. And the other guy was the drummer was sort of couldn't keep regular time and would he would sit there. Then he would occasionally sort of attack the drums, you know, with fury, and then sit down again. So he was either very behind the times or miles ahead, a la John Cage, you know, sort of serial music. But no, Charterhouse, when I moved on to Charterhouse, which is where the Genesis guys, we eventually formed, well, what kept became a team of songwriters to start with, but only Mike Rutherford of the group was involved at that era. So we formed basically what you'd call a covers band now, you know, doing Beatles, Stones, Kinks, Animals, Yardbirds, some throwback to the Shadows. And Mike Rutherford was the rhythm guitarist. I was the lead guitarist. And dear friend of mine, Rivers Jobe, who's not with us anymore, was the bassist. And we had a very good drummer called Rob Tyrrell. And so we kind of took the school by storm, but it was rather frowned upon by the authorities because this is the 60s, you know, and the 50s have been a kind of a period of, well, in Watership Down, they called it SARN, you know, sort of stasis, really. Everything, you know, things hadn't moved on. And suddenly there's this explosion of color. And we were part of that kind of incredible period of change. And the authorities felt very threatened by it. It was too early for drugs, but we did tend to attract some of the what you might call not ne'er-do-wells, but the guys that weren't particularly good at sport or academics. And so it was seen as possibly a not particularly constructive influence, if you like. So we met with opposition, definitely. You know, if you did badly in your sort of form order, you were banned for playing the guitar for 2 weeks. That's how they could get at you. So, and Mike Rutherford particularly was in a very difficult house where the housemaster was a real he was a very troubled man actually, because he later committed suicide, God rest his soul, but he was a very troubled man. He was very sadistic, and I think in those days there were a lot of people who were very damaged by the war still, you know, and it was all the stuff was not being treated, it was undiagnosed. So yeah, we had sort of mixed dealings with that really, but yeah, so that was I mean, it was great fun taking on, because I think, you know, there were lots of millions of groups doing this, but I think we were reasonably good, and we were certainly the best at our school, which had 600 or 700 boys, so we had quite accolades then. I mean, Mike Rutherford and I had met at that stage early, so we were sort of simpatico, and we gradually morphed into writing, courtesy of actually mainly courtesy, and we were writing sort of bad blues stuff, but I stumbled across a guy in the summer of the famous Summer of Love, as they've dubbed it, 67, playing a 12 string in a field. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing sound. So I got my parents to buy me a very cheap 12 string. And that was the start of Mike and I experimenting with 12 strings in a, you know, kind of 12 string timbres and things, and just things that were slightly. We weren't copying anybody because before that we'd been copyists. And parallel to this, in my house, I'd got to know two elder boys called Peter Gabriel and Tony Banks. And Tony Banks was a very good pianist. And there were other guys in the house who were very good pianists. And they'd all have a kind of rival thing for being able to play the most recent hit by so and so. Peter Gabriel was actually very quiet to start with, very unprepossessing, nice chap. But very quiet and not rebellious at all, whereas Mike and I we were the more rebellious wing. Peter sort of almost overnight suddenly developed a very eccentric streak, and he started dyeing our shirts for us, turquoise, because you were only allowed to wear shirts that were slightly off-white. And he designed a hat that was actually patented by a company called Dunkirk, Piccadilly. And when he bought a car, he bought a decommissioned cab, which was very, very, very trendy in those days. So he was basically driving a London taxi, a decommissioned London taxi.
Okay.
So Mike and I started getting together with the other two and writing, and we were probably more primitive. I mean, I hadn't realized Pete could sing for the first 2 years I was there, and suddenly he was, 'cause he, as I say, he was quite a shy guy, and he remained so. But he'd suddenly be on the dining room table, sort of cavorting and singing, and it was like, hang on, this guy's got an alter ego. There's a different side to this man, you know, when he's acting, if you like, or when he's assuming a persona. And this actually translated itself to when we went on the road and we did what we call a schoolboy album with Jonathan King, which was basically quite amateurish and didn't do a lot. But it was, you know, we learned a fair bit. But we decided to give it a after our exams, we decided to give it a go and sort of go on the road and just see if we could get anywhere doing it that way around. So before that, we'd really just been songwriters, is the truth of it. I mean, Tony Banks was an accomplished keyboard player. I was a reasonable electric guitarist. Mike had been a rhythm guitarist who sort of just taught himself bass. And so we were a bit of a ramshackle crew, actually. We saw ourselves as composers. We were signed initially to a publishing company called John Joe, which was Joe Roncarone and Jonathan King, and as songwriters. But we were coming up with these sort of 5-minute epics, which was not what they wanted at all. Jonathan King very much wanted us in the style of the stuff he was doing, which was very, very poppy. And we did do a couple of singles that were very poppy. And to this day, I think it's the best thing that ever happened to the group. They weren't successful because had they been, we'd have been directed down this poppy conduit and we'd never have done the experimental stuff that came later that led to some of the greater, what is now called prog tracks of theirs. So yes, we went on the road and initially Pete was very, very, very shy. Mike Rutherford and I used to spend so long tuning the 12 strings because the 12 strings would go out of tune. And it was all quite primitive in those days because you're sitting quite close to the amplifiers, which would feed back with the pickup put on the acoustic 12 string. So we get this dreadful thing where it wasn't so much the sort of screeching cat's feedback, but that sort of that kind of funnel noise from a ship. And neither of us would know which one of us it was. So we both turned down and leave Pete sort of singing by himself. It was really chaotic, actually. But so basically that at one stage he was so nervous that the roadie, our main roadie, was going to do the announcements. But I think Pete owes us something, Mike and I, because without our 12 strings going out of tune, he'd never have invented this persona where he started getting outside the Peter Gabriel we knew and looking at the audience straight on and talking. I mean, I never heard this stuff because I was busy deep in 12 string out of tune land and, you know, saying to Mike, are you okay? Are you ready to go? And all the time was Pete was sort of developing this persona, this all these mythical stories and letting his imagination, which is very fertile, just and people lapped, they really lapped onto it. And of course, it grew and grew and grew. And he became a legend for that, courtesy of our out of tune 12 strings. I'd unfortunately had glandular fever before we went on the road, which I didn't know much about at the time, but it was the illest I've ever been. And I then had to go straight into exams, what we call my A level exams, which is the ones you do for university. And I sort of managed to get through those. What I didn't know is that glandular fever can affect you for a year to a year and a half afterwards, and you have to be very careful with, you know, what you do, your health and stuff. And when we went on the road, although we were middle class boys and we had some help with the equipment from parents, it went no further than that. So we were doing gigs on a shoestring. And you know, the main roadie was a friend of ours who would just bring along a sort of packed supper. You know, we didn't go out to restaurants or socialize with guys. And we ended up by sort of doss if we were too far from home, we'd end up by just kind of dossing down on someone's floor. And this was during the winter, so it's actually pretty tough. And I, because we were living pretty roughly at times, it affected my health, and I started getting sort of semi-glandular fever symptoms, which was irritating to the others. You know, I mean, we didn't cancel gigs at that stage. I'll never know if it was connected, because I have heard stories since that glandular fever can cause problems with your nervous system. I was actually going out with an Australian girl who told me that her brother had been a hockey goalkeeper and got glandular fever, and it just sort of he was never a hockey goalkeeper again. But I started developing this sort of chronic stage fright, not just sort of nerves, but where you sort of, you kind of been, you could sort of think you're just going to get on stage and not be able to remember anything. Apparently, it's a classic actor's thing. You're sort of saying it and not knowing how you're saying it. And I was looking at my fingers and thinking, how am I doing it? And of course, because it was such a freaky and weird experience, I couldn't really talk about it to the others. So I endured 2 or 3 months of what was purgatory, to be honest. We were so well drilled that I played sort of like a robot, really. But every time going on stage and thinking, oh my God, I'm going to mess this up, because there was a lot of pressure. We were trying to get a record company, trying to get a major agent interested, and we'd flogged our guts out. And it was like everyone, it was like a big pressure. You've got to perform, you've got to perform. And eventually I got bronchial pneumonia, which sounds worse than it is. It wasn't actually that bad, not as bad as the glandular, but it was like my mind held up, but my body sort of went under. And I recovered from that, which was it was annoying for the others because we had to cancel some gigs. I was advised by doctors after that, because of my health, actually not a good idea, really. And I think things in the group had got a bit, inevitably, if you all live too close together, which we did. We didn't have the wisdom to know you need to get space from each other. And we lived on top of each other, and we all got quite irritated. And I think the vibe in the band was relationships. I won't say broke down, but it wasn't a lot of fun. There was no time to rehearse any new material either, because we've been gig after gig after gig. Our music being quite complex, it took quite a while to write a new piece and knock it into shape, so that it could be performed properly. It wouldn't just happen. You couldn't do it in an afternoon. So we were doing the same material for a long time, and it got very dull from that point of view. And tempers got frayed. And I think, looking back on it, taking an objective view, I think there were too many composers in the group. It's quite unusual. I mean, there are other bands that have had 4 or 5 composers, but it isn't the norm. If you go through most of the groups, I mean, there are some, obviously, but and I think that probably that although what happened to me wasn't directly affected by that, I think it was probably an inevitable consequence that something had to give, because there were too many people with sort of strong ideas. I think it's no wonder that they ended up with three main, writers. Because by that stage, they had their areas of delineation completely marked. You got one guy who's the singer, the drummer, who writes, another guy who handles all the keyboard wing, another guy who handles all the guitar wing. There was we had sort of duplication, if you like, when I was in the group, and it wasn't that easy, actually. So yes, so I then left in many ways reluctantly, and mooched around a bit, and then studied the formal side of music, sort of in some respects slightly reluctantly, because I found aspects of it were a bit set, a bit dyed in the wool. But other aspects of it were vital, because I wanted to write orchestral music, because we'd had an experience on the first album where we'd had to use an arranger and we had no say. So he put all these string lines and horn lines, which were kind of alien to us, really. I remember having a sort of Road to Damascus thing, hearing Sibelius's Corellia Suite, and thinking, wow, because I think when I was growing up, I associated classical music with the sort of Mozart and Beethoven period, the very kind of quite ornate, but quite arguably a little bit dry and a little bit mannered, maybe. I mean, obviously everyone has their own opinion, but I preferred stuff that was much more romantic, from the Romantic Impressionist period, with more modern harmonies. And once I started hearing stuff like that, Debussy, Ravel, and all those kind of people, it was a bit of a, it was quite a, it was quite a revelation. And I wanted to know how to do all that. I studied part time, because I didn't learn to read music till I was 19. I learned piano more formally because the early writing was very, very informal. I mean, it was some of the actually I wrote the basic part of Visions of Angels like that with the old style, but I was very limited. So it was frustrating having to sort of relearn, if you like, and sight read at snail's pace. And I used to get really, really impatient. But it was worth it. Yeah, and I qualified as a classical guitar teacher, so I had letters after my name. I had a fallback position. And then, Genesis had got to the point where people started to do solo albums. There was a summer. So Mike Rutherford and I, because we'd had a pool of material before we went on the road, only some of which was used. So we used some of that, or quite a lot of it, as the basis for what became The Geese and the Ghost. But it was actually recorded quite a lot earlier than when it came out. For various reasons. And it was a bit ironic because when it came out, people, the prog era was beginning to fade, and it was the wrong timing. And also, I was getting stick. They were saying he's cashing in on the Genesis lead singer. And actually, when Phil did the recordings in 75, they were still auditioning other singers. There's no way he was the Genesis singer in those days. So it was a little bit unfair. But yeah, it was the timing was not good because we then had punk and disco, and I mean, history reads that the prog bands sort of, they very much suffered a backlash from the press. There was a complete sort of volte-face. Suddenly, everyone was supposed to be doing angry 17 or 18-year-old pop songs, rock songs, and I mean, I saw the whole thing as a kind of journey from the Beatles taking us through Love Me Do, Please Please Me, right to Day in the Life, and the whole thing was a musical journey. And then I felt that then there was the underground scene with bands like Family and Proko Harum doing these longer tracks, which had slight, often quite classical influences, but just much more experimental in form, complete experiences. That journey continued. And somewhere along the line, I think maybe it got a bit, some of the stuff by the bands got a bit convoluted. And so it was inevitable there was going to be some kind of a backlash. I do remember there was a constant cry, where's the new Beatles, and but it was rather undignified the way that the press and certainly the record companies as well rather kind of turned on some of yesterday's heroes, as it were, and kind of knifed them in the back. It wasn't a particularly edifying time. So little old me enters the stage around this time, completely bad timing. And obviously, my record reviews were awful because people just didn't, the press, it wasn't cool. It was cool to be angry. And I mean, I was only 26. I was younger than the Police, Stranglers, and other people who hadn't made it first time rounds, some of them. But it was just the wrong style for the wrong time. So I can't say earlier it would have been successful anyway, but it was difficult because I found myself being told what style to write in. I think computers have liberated people very much in that respect. You can record at home, you can do your own thing, and you're not at the behest of a record company. In those days, you could only get, the only way you could get your music recorded was going into a big studio, 24-track tape, not endless tracks on a computer. And you had to do what the guys in the industry said. So I found myself having to write the sort of pop songs that we were having a go at doing not terribly well 10 years previously. And I found it a bit of a struggle. I mean, some of them were all right, but some of them were a bit crass, and I didn't feel comfortable with it. And of course, the people that liked The Geese and the Ghosts were saying, what are you doing? Why are you? And one had to try and explain, well, sorry, Gov, it's not me, it's the record company. They want this kind of thing. So I think we were all in those days sort of steered very much by record company demands, unless you had a big enough following that would stay faithful to you. But I think there was quite a lot of on the fence stuff. I remember meeting a guy when we were playing cricket, believe it or not, and years later, who said to me, he was a bit younger than me, Well, no, he would have been about 5 years younger than me. He said he went up to Nottingham University with his copy of The Geese and the Ghost, and he said he had to get rid of it because it was so unfashionable. You know, people were laughing at him. Yeah, no,
Wow.
that it was a real witch hunt here. It was a real witch hunt. It was one or the other kind of thing. It was very undiscriminating, which and unforgiving, and there was very much two sides to it. You know, that there wasn't a sort of mutual respect. I've always made a big contrast between the way that when the Beatles and the Stones came in, we still respected the Shadows and people like that, but you know, we just didn't listen to this stuff so much. There wasn't a sort of campaign of vitriol,
Yeah.
and the press, it seemed to be a competition for who could be as nasty about some of the bands as possible. Yes went to the States, ELP went to Italy. I think England was not a pleasurable place to be for a lot of musicians at that time. So I found myself drifting away from that and into doing television music because, you know, basically my face really didn't fit. During the 80s, I did quite a lot of television music, quite a lot of attempting to write songs for other people, but I've never really had the sort of what I would call the commercial touch. You know, the ability. There's just something that, some people have, which is the ability to write a song that everybody wants to cover. I think it's quite rare. If you look amongst the prog bands, there's very few of them that have had songs sort of covered by major artists, you know, in the way that someone like Yesterday has been covered so many times. Yeah, I found myself doing then a lot of wildlife stuff in the 90s, which was great. And, you know, I carried on doing albums, but they were much smaller scale. You know, guitar pieces, piano pieces, and some sort of dreamy synth stuff. And had a bit of a turn up for the books in the late 80s when I got signed to Virgin as a Virgin Publishing and also then Virgin Records. And I was able to do a much bigger album called Slow Dance, which was a much more sort of arranged and larger piece. And that was very popular with some of the fans, but not, funny enough, not popular at all in America. They didn't sort of really get that. They much preferred an album before, which was in the sort of new age. I don't know if you're aware, there was a sort of era in the mid 80s where there was this kind of new age boom, which was basically kind of backcloth music to pictures and stuff. And a lot of it, a lot of people thought it was very boring. I think its main function for a lot of people was it was a kind of a background to something else, you know, healing, if you're doing yoga, any of those kind of things. It really
Yes,
worked. It was very, very calming, but it wasn't about development. You couldn't suddenly switch to a 7/8 section in the middle of a quart section, you know, because people were chilling, you know, so you had to stay on one level. So you couldn't really do anything that was particularly dynamic. And therefore, I mean, it was quite nice in the sort of hypnotic sense, but quite dull in terms of the ability to be musically adventurous, really. And the album Slow Dance I did, which was, you know, the bigger canvas album, was had a lot of changes, not for the sake of it, but just, you know, more like, you know, you listen to an orchestral piece and it doesn't all go along on one level. You know, there's a
Yes.
lot of changes and highs and lows and dynamics. So then along the way, I was very lucky because I started doing what was rather disparagingly called library music in those days, and it was regarded as kind of stock background music.
Yeah.
But it grew in strength with more TV channels, whereby, and also particularly where programs needed to be turned around quickly, weekly programs, documentaries and stuff. Somebody needed music, then got time to get a guy to come in and, you know, do brief him, demos, take them away. It's all got to be done within a day or two. So, with the advent of computers as well, editors could download the stuff. They go on, do searches, find tracks,
Yeah.
download them. And then, you know, when you do library music, which became now it's called production music, you do actually sign away the rights. I mean, it could be used in a porn film. That's the only downside, but you don't know much about that.
Yeah.
I remember making 4 grand from a piece of music that we used on a catwalk in a Finnish model thing. You know, you
Yeah.
think, well, this is pretty weird. I was lucky in that I never got asked to do anything that was really cheap. I think the worst it was sort of maybe a bit backgroundy, a bit functional, you know, like just kind of drones with slightly unfolding sounds on top. But I never had to do any what I would call irritating, chirpy kind of like some adverts, and so
Yes.
nothing ever to be really ashamed about. I was quite lucky because I had a foil between the library music, which was making some good money finally, and being able then also to do more simple solo albums on the side. Basically, the 90s and the 2000s, really. Really, really lucky. Now, the trouble is that then a lot of when Spotify and stuff like that came in, a lot of rock musicians realized, the royalties started to go down, and touring was what touring became essential. Everyone tried to pile into library music because it could be essentially a form of pension, really.
Yes.
And of course, it's got to a stage of overkill now. There's too much. There's too many companies, and I mean, I was really lucky to get in at a time where there wasn't that saturation of the market, because there certainly is now. So that's a sort of brief synopsis of where we are.
The difference between doing library music or production music, as you call it, and
Yeah.
doing music for yourself, is there one you prefer more than the other? Or is it just, okay, cool, today I'm focusing on production music, tomorrow I'm focusing on creating music for an album? Are they equally enjoyable for you?
Your own album work is going to be closest to your heart. I mean, sometimes takes longer to do. For instance, I mean, the most recent guitar album I did was called a solo album. It's called Strings of Light, which was a guitar album, and it took a lot of work because I was doing a lot of library music. I wasn't sort of fighting fit in terms of my technique. I could pick up a guitar and play a piece of music that sounded quite, nice, or hopefully nice in bits. But the difference between that and it being concert standard, if you like, for an album, and also the stat, not just the ability to play it well, but to have the stamina. Because what I didn't want to do was do it in edits. Some of these pieces, I didn't want to sort of do one bit, then another bit, because then you don't get the dynamic flow and the build. So what we did was, like with my engineer, we would do what a lot of people do, which is you do the whole track, and then when you aren't covered on certain sections where you don't feel it's quite right, or maybe there's a wrong note or a flaw, you actually drop in for that section, but you've got the build. But the price of that was the old thing of, it's 5% inspiration, 95% perspiration. So lots and lots of practice. So I think the stuff dearest to your heart is always going to be your solo albums. But there's a joy with library music, which is you can create a track in 5 minutes and that's it, done. Because I would do some synth things where I would maybe have two or three keyboards with different sounds. I'd maybe have a drone bass here. I'd have a melody sound here, and I'd have some ornamental effects here. And I could actually literally even four keyboards at a time and hold something with the pedal. So I could create a track sometimes, which would probably cost me 5 minutes of my life. And actually, that was great, that quick turnaround. And I think also, I mean, there are so many fantastic companies producing sounds now. I mean, it's mind-boggling selecting what to buy in terms of what we call virtual instruments, the stuff that you play on your keyboard, because there are so many great sounds. And I mean, I think for me, the Spitfire are very good on orchestral stuff, but on non-orchestral stuff, there's a company called Spectrasonics. I'm not sure if you're aware of them, but from the start, they've been absolutely brilliant. They kicked off with things like one was called Distorted Reality, and you still hear some of the samples on that today. It was run by a guy called Eric Persing that we used to call God, and he is actually a God-fearing man, actually, Eric. But unbelievable. They did a thing called Omnisphere, which was just stunning. I mean, I sometimes joke that a gorilla could do a good library album. You go away on holiday, leave the gorilla in there, because you just put your finger on one key and it starts doing this amazing unfolding, undulating, developing wave. I mean, not quite. Yeah, so you're spoilt for choice now. It's like a child in a vast sweet shop. Vast, vast, vast sweet shop. Not knowing it's, I mean, it's all wonderful, or well, a lot of it's wonderful. Sometimes, obviously, as you're going through the sound library, you're coming across stuff that you think is maybe not quite as good as others, but it's impossible. I would say it's impossible to keep up now, because there's just so much. You have to be very selective about what you choose.
What keeps you motivated to stay in the industry, whether it's production music, doing your own albums? What is it that every morning gets that fire in your belly and says, okay, cool, I'm going to carry on today and create something amazing?
I think that, well, I can't speak for everyone, but I would have thought from painters to poets to novelists to musicians or composers that it's something in the blood, isn't it? You kind of need it for your well-being, for your self-expression. Some people are more mercenary about it. Obviously, they do it for a specific purpose and then they retire. But I think if it's a love and it's a vital form of getting things out of your system. I think artists are very lucky in that way, which is, they can express some of their feelings that could come out in less constructive ways. I'm not necessarily saying violent, but they're able to express it through music and sometimes to capture an emotion or a time or a scene in a way that makes you feel, a degree of pride afterwards. I mean, as much as that, I feel quite a lot of embarrassment about stuff I've done as well. So, I mean, it's a real mixture. But I think we are blessed. I think I just love the sound. I mean, if I pick up a 12 string, certain chords just thrill me still. I don't think that's ever going to go, to be honest. I mean, you can overdo it, obviously, if you've spent too much time on it. But I don't think that ever goes. I don't see how it could do, really. And the same with piano. More bit more complicated on the computer side, because I think as the computer side gets more complicated, older brains find it more difficult to keep up with. So probably that's going to become a bit of a limitation, because you're constantly having to go to sort of night school to relearn this stuff as it develops. I've grown to love the piano so much as well. That the combination of the two is a great, again, they're a great foil to each other. You have too much guitar, you go to piano, and also covering different types of guitar as well. I mean, less electric, although I have been mucking about with electric through a lot of fancy pedals and stuff, which make it not sound like an electric guitar. So again, we're talking about more sort of ambient kind of stuff, using an electric guitar in that way to create huge sound pictures where you're not quite sure what the instrument is, particularly if you use a volume pedal. So there's a huge range of stuff across the pianistic and the guitaristic, as they call it, palette to enjoy. I think they probably, you would probably tend to say, a musician will die when his head just goes bang down on the piano lid, providing his hands can still play. So I can't speak for everybody, but that's the way it is for me.
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. UK, USA is the main audience, South Africa, naturally, Australia, Belgium. So as a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
Well, I'd first of all like to thank all the fans of mine that have persevered through all the eras of what would appear to be incomprehensible changes. But I would say that bear in mind that the record companies dictated a lot of that. And then, of course, the lack of finance dictated the paring down of things. And so very much I would love to have developed the Geese and the Ghosts style and done elaborated on that, but that was very much cut short by the change in the record industry at the time. Thank the people also from whom I've had some wonderful feedback about, out tracks or albums that have helped people through difficult periods and have meant something to them. I mean, that's worth its weight in gold. It makes up for all the 95% perspiration part. I mean, how long I'm going to be able to go on making records, I don't know really. That remains to be seen. But I mean, we've been doing a series of re-releases through Cherry Red, where we've tried to always firstly remaster, but more importantly, I think, is also include a bonus CD that isn't, as my friend Steve Hackett calls it, a bogus CD. A bonus CD of proper tracks, not just chuck away stuff or demos done in the toilet, that kind of stuff. Things that have a connection that are contemporaneous with the time. And I'm extremely lucky because I have a guy called Jonathan Dan, who used to work at the BBC. And he's been forensic in going through old tapes and discovering material that is of the time. And for instance, they're releasing my wildlife CD, and you have to decide which of the pieces that work without a picture that you think stand. The danger is that they're not long enough for people, and they don't develop enough, because again, you're fulfilling the discipline here of actually following a picture. But so you have to be very selective. And yes, it isn't perfect from that point of view. But what we've tried to do with some of it is create suites where you segue from one piece into the other that needs careful architecture to make it work and flow. And John has managed to find some decent stuff. You know, it's not chuck away stuff. People find it valuable for their collection, because I think getting people, it's like people asking to buy a painting twice. I always feel guilty about it. But people will do it because they're completists, but I feel it's irresponsible to not try and add something which is really significantly extra to the original.
Listeners, go out and get Anthony's retrospective or the re-releases of his music. So, Anthony, it's been a pleasure having you on Slep Savant. Thank you for your time today. And this is Slep Savant signing out.